A very warm welcome. You're listening to Share Radio. I'm Georgie Frost, here with you every weekday from 9 until 1 on digital, online and through the Share Radio mobile app, making the pound in your pocket go a little bit further. The team from This Is Money, the award-winning finance website, are back in the studio with me for our weekly catch-up, talking through the stories they've been tackling this week. And today I'm joined by editor Simon Lambert and journalist Rachel Rickard-Strauss. And on the agenda today, forget mice or even mega moths, there's a new nocturnal pest entering your homes. Cold callers. Unwanted marketing calls waking us up in the middle of the night are on the rise. It's not only annoying, it's illegal. Time to hit back. We'll tell you how. Weatherspoons has warned the national living wage could push some troubled pubs over the edge. Next, and Costa coffee owner Whitbread also warning prices will have to go up.
Some unintended consequences from the living wage. Many more younger people going into lower paid occupations and not getting the skills to develop into higher earning jobs.
Also, find out which banks you voted best current account provider again and the worst again. It comes as banks are falling over themselves to get you to switch to them. What are the best deals out there? Also, it could save us thousands of pounds. But why are we still stubbornly using the much moaned about high street estate agents rather than heading online?
We do the whole hand-holding bit all the way from point of inquiry all the way through to completion, exactly the same as a traditional agent.
A new 5p tax for plastic bags comes in from next month. T's and C's, of course, do apply. Bananas, razor blades and live fish are exempt. And it's time to indulge in a spot of car envy. Rolls-Royce reckon they've made the sexiest model ever, owned by Germany, inspired by Italy, but importantly, made in Britain.
We looked at these fabulous, very rare Rolls-Royce Silver Dawn models from the 1950s. They came to the market at a time where the world was coming out a period of austerity, and they really sort of put a sense of Dolce Vita back into automotive super luxury grand touring.
Yeah, it's at the not-so-sweet price of a quarter of a million. But if money were no issue, we're asking today, what is your dream car? You can have anything you want. Money, no issue. Time, no issue, even if they don't do the car anymore. A very good morning, Simon Lambert. A very good morning, Rachel Rickard-Strauss. I'm going to start with you, Simon. Your dream car, anything you could have.
Do you know what? I actually bought my dream car, but it was a Peugeot 205 GTI, and they don't cost a phenomenal amount of money. I'd always wanted one, and I bought myself one. But I would have an E-Type Jag. In fact, what I'd actually want is a garage full of classic cars.
All right, Simon, just the one. We only allowed you one.
E-Type, then.
All right, then. I said a VW camper van.
That's a good choice.
Thank you.
It's a good choice. I went to my wedding in a VW camper van. Well, I didn't go to it. I left my wedding in a VW camper van. My wife arrived in one because her stepdad's got one.
Sentimental as well. Rachel, you?
Just don't get it. Car lost. Don't get it at all. This new Dawn car that we've been talking about, they call the roof mechanism the silent ballet. I don't get it at all, this comparison. Go see a ballet. Why get a car with a roof that... So if I have to have one, can I invent one?
Yeah, why not?
Okay, so driverless, electric, and also if it could swivel 360 degrees, so no matter what way you've... I mean, it would have to be quite small to do that to fit in a parking spot, but that's fine, a little one-person car. If it could swivel 360 degrees, so that if you've parked one way, you can just swivel in your spot and then drive out the other, that would be great.
Do you know that you can get something for your drive that does that? A turntable for your
driver.
You park your car on your drive and then you can turn your car around and drive back out the right way.
It's brilliant.
Presumably it's for people who live on like really busy roads or things like that. I like the sound of your car that you've designed, Rachel. Although I don't think it's as good as the one Homer Simpson once designed.
To celebrate Share Radio's first year, we're giving away a Pure Evoke D2 digital radio every single week. Many lucky winners have already received theirs and you could be next. To enter, visit shareradio.co.uk, register your details and you'll be entered into the weekly draw. Open to UK residents over the age of 16. Visit our website for full terms and conditions. Share Radio, sharing ideas about money.
A very warm welcome. I'm Georgie Frost. This is Share Radio on digital, online and through the Share Radio mobile app. The team from This Is Money, the award-winning finance website, back in the studio for their weekly catch-up, running through some of the stories that they've been looking at over the last 7 days. And I'm joined today by editor Simon Lambert, journalist Rachel Rickard-Strauss. And coming up, have Rolls-Royce just unveiled their sexiest car ever? But with the Chinese slowdown, is there trouble afoot in the luxury car market? But first, let's take a look at the most popular story on the This Is Money website this week. And it's the rise of a new nocturnal pest entering our homes in the dead of night to wake us up. It is cold callers. Always the bane of our domestic bliss, but now we're seeing an increase in the volume of calls at antisocial hours, waking us up from our peaceful slumbers. It's not nice, it's extremely annoying, but importantly for us in the fight back against this unwanted pest, it is illegal. Is that not right, Rachel?
It is, yes. If you're on the TPS, so you've asked specifically not to get cold calls, and then you receive cold calls, that is illegal. This story that we've had this week is about people in the town of Market Harborough who were woken up by a cold call at about 4 a.m, which is, it was dreadful anyway to be woken up. But, I mean, we all think the same thing, don't you, when you get a phone call at that time. Someone's died or, you know, something terrible's happened. Otherwise, why would anyone phone you? The reason why it happened is it was a lot of these calls are computer generated and they got the timings wrong. And so the call went out at the wrong time. I think the appeal, particularly of this story, and we've had a few like it over the years, people love the idea of getting revenge on the phone pests. And we've had 1,800 comments on this story. Similarly before, people love to share their ideas for getting your own back. The dream really is to phone them back, get hold of the boss's numbers and phone them back in the middle of the night. But then there's all sorts of things that people like to do, honking or, it's not honking, oinking down the phone.
So what actually can you do to get results rather than honking down the phone?
Well, so... That might get results.
It might do, but is there anything official that we can do?
So officially, you can, first of all, sign up to the Telephone Preference Service. It's free. There's been a recent scam recently of people cold calling, telling people that they have to pay to go on this TPS. So be careful. Make sure you sign up to the right one and don't pay for it. If you still continue to get phone calls, then complain. It's very easy to do it. I do it at least once a day at the moment. Get in touch with the Information Commissioner's office. They overlook the automated phone calls and they do telesales phone calls as well. And the more that people complain, the bigger the sort of bank of information they have to go after these cold callers. Types of things you have to note down. If you can, get any details of what they're offering, the phone number, what time they phone, what phone number they're phoning you on, and just the more information that you can provide, the better.
And this affects a lot of people. Last year, 22 million households subjected to a variety of nuisance calls. But it's not just households, is it, Simon?
22 million and one.
Your office?
Me. I've got a phone pest that rings me once.
This isn't just people complaining about articles or anything that you've written.
No. This is a phone pest, an automated call that I get once or twice every single day on my landline at work. And I know the number. It starts 9084. I just pick the phone up and I don't even listen to it. I just pick it up and put it down. And it's either to do with some loan that they claim I can get cancelled or PPI. But Rachel has been taking it upon herself to complain about this, I think, to the Information Commissioner's office to try and get it stopped.
And success?
A couple of months down the line, I still get the phone call every day.
Well, I mean, I just do exactly as I just said. I sort of give the details of the phone call and they say, thanks very much. We'll add this to our bank of information. And if they can find out who it is, there are significant fines that they can dish out. But I think that it's sort of finding that information. A lot of them will be withheld numbers or they won't be based in the UK. And there are all sorts of ways around it. If you are lucky enough to get a cold call from an actual person, really, that's the best because you can find out all sorts of information about what the firm is. It's easier to get to the root of what I always try to get to the root of, how they got hold of my personal information, ask to be taken off their database. If I can, I speak to a manager and ask them how they got hold of my information and then go back to whatever company that is. If you can sort of get to the source of it, where your number is being given out from, you stand a chance of cutting them down. But it's really, it's such a faff, isn't it?
The thing about these cold calls is it sounds like a trivial thing, doesn't it, to be complaining about this. It's like, oh, so what, you've got to answer the phone and then put the phone down. But it drives people crazy. And at my mum's house during the daytime, she gets them all day long. She doesn't answer the phone anymore. But then you start getting them on your mobile as well. Apparently, the biggest fine that's been imposed so far is £750,000, which was handed out to Home Insurer HomeServe in 2012, because it was abandoning thousands of calls when they were answered by recipients. But that's a reputable company. With some of these cold calls, it's just, you really don't know where they're coming from, and you just think, how on earth are the authorities going to track them down? So you can get these boxes that show you the number or block a call. You've got BT Privacy with caller display for £1.75 a month that lets you see the number of the person calling, so you can choose not to answer it. Separately, it has a choose-to-refuse service at £4.15 a month that allows you to block up to 10 numbers you want to banish. And it also has an anonymous call rejection service to stop withheld numbers getting through, costing £5.05.
These are expensive,
though. This is expensive. There's a lot of money to be paying on top of your line rental to block these calls. But you can also buy a gadget, a £40 CPR 1200 number capacity nuisance call blocker, which is supposedly meant to block these. But my concern about blocking anonymous calls has always been that if someone is calling you from an office or an exchange or something like that, quite often their number will come up as withheld.
Doctors,
hospitals, things like that. And I don't know whether the system has changed and now hospitals and doctors and the police and people have got round that and made it so their numbers will appear. But that was always my concern about just blanket blocking any calls, is actually you might miss out on something important.
No, indeed. Let's turn our attention to a story that's got much coverage this week, and that is the National Living Wage. Wetherspoons, the latest to voice concerns over the introduction next April of the wage rise to £7.20 an hour for workers over 25. They say it could push some troubled pubs over the edge. The retailer Next and Costa coffee owner Whitbread also warned prices will have to go up. Helen Dickinson from the British Retail Consortium expects shops on the high street to follow similar tactics.
All retailers that I talk to are certainly really thinking hard about, you know, the training that they give, the investment that they make in their people, and how they can enable the business to be able to cover the cost of the increase.
Simon, firstly, we have living wage, national living wage, minimum wage. Clear us up for us, please.
Well, the idea behind the national living wage is that people don't get paid enough money, and this is to give them enough money to live on. And what underlies all of this is, and I do have some sympathy with the shops, etc., but we don't pay people enough money in this country, and we've got a low-wage economy that has been subsidised for many, many years by the tax credit system, and we're cutting back on tax credits. So the Chancellor has said that basically people need to be paid more money. And actually, I agree with that. And what's interesting about some of the warnings that have come out is probably the next one, where Next has said, yes, it will add to the bill, but it will only be 1% on prices over 4 years, which is not a huge amount, really.
No, when you compare how much that 70 pence, which is going up in April, I believe, will make to the lives of many thousands of workers.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And in Next figures here, basically, it said the cost of implementing this, it reckoned, would be £11 million, getting all staff up to the minimum level. But it also pinpointed this knock-on effect, where they'll have to raise the wages of people who are higher up the scale, and that will be an extra £16 million. So that will actually cost more than the national living wage itself. And I suppose that is something to take into account. But in reality, if you pay your staff more money, they have more money in their pockets and they can spend more money. They're not just employees, they are also the population at large. I don't see how it can't be a good thing, going from a wage judged to be too little for people to live on to a wage that's judged to be slightly closer to what they need.
We spoke to James Hick from Manpower. They carried out a bit of research about this, which shows that some businesses, they say, are already scaling back their hiring plans before the living wage kicks in, and they're even looking to hire younger workers to get round the extra cost.
Maybe some unintended consequences from the living wage, and that might be about many more younger people going into lower paid occupations such as care and social work, and not getting the skills to develop into higher earning jobs.
Rachel, pros and cons, perhaps you agree that the living wage will have some unintended consequences like that could be negative for businesses and consumers as well.
Yeah, but I suppose you just have to look at it on balance. And if, as Simon says, if you have people with more money in their pockets who are customers as well, then that's got to be good for businesses. So long as there's a level playing field, I mean, by passing it as law, everyone has to do it. It's not like Next is having to take this upon itself to do it, and it's competing against, you know, Marks and Spencer's, Asda, whoever, who isn't doing it. Everyone has to do it, so it's fair.
There's a business argument to this, isn't there? Pay more, you get perhaps better staff retention, less sickness as well. Also a moral argument.
What do we want to be a low-wage economy? Do we want to live in a fairer society? The people that we're talking about earning this money are the people who are near the bottom of the scale when it comes to wages. And should we be trying to drag them up? What the coalition government did that was very, very good, and what the Conservatives have committed to, is raising that tax-free allowance, that personal allowance, before you start paying tax. And that has gone up an awful lot over the last 4 or 5 years. And I think that's another very important part of the jigsaw. Mm. And I don't think that companies should be making profits and paying dividends back to their shareholders that are essentially being subsidised by tax credits. They are able to pay their staff less money than they need to live on because the rest of us, the state, but you or I as taxpayers, are picking up the tab and that extra money is flowing out to investors. Now, the one reason why people support the tax credit system is because what it does is it removes some of this cliff edge of where it's not worth working. So it phases people in. So if you go from being long-term unemployed to working, you don't suddenly actually miss out on all your benefits. But to put the figures in context, the national minimum wage per hour depends on your age. So if you're 21 and over, it's from the 1st of October this year, it's £6.70. And if you're 18 to 20, it's £5.30. If you're under 18, you get the princely sum of £3.87. And if you are an apprentice, you get £3.30. So the compare the national living wage, which will be £7.20 from April 2016. So it's going to be an extra 50p. But that's only going to be for people who are 25 and older. Mm. So those who are 21 to 24 are still going to get their £6.70. One of the interesting things in the NEXT figures as well, NEXT laid this out really nicely in their annual report, in their half-year report, is it said it's going to cost £27 million to do the national minimum wage stuff, but that bill pales into insignificance compared to just general wage inflation, which it forecasts is going to cost it £120 million over that same four-year period. So I think maybe businesses are talking up the effect of this a little bit more than it will actually be.
What's interesting is the energy company SSE, I mean, let's be honest, come in for quite a bit of slack recently, energy companies, paying its staff the even higher living wage for a couple of years now. So Rachel McEwen, who's the Director of Sustainability there, says, no one wants a situation where people are in work but also living in poverty. We think there's a role for people and companies like us to reach standards that are higher than the statutory minimum. Your thoughts on that, Rachel?
Well, it makes perfect sense for them as well. As you say, if you become a more desirable place to work, you retain your staff, people are happier. And also, I think you're right, there is a moral obligation as well. There's also, we talk a lot about productivity and the productivity gap. While labour is cheap, then there's less incentive for companies to invest in IT infrastructures, technology or processes. What will have to happen in order for this move to be cost effective, companies that have been paying staff cheaper wages will have to find a way to become efficient in other ways and invest, and that's a good thing.
That voice you're hearing, Rachel Rickard-Strauss, also in the studio, editor Simon Lambert from This Is Money.
Morning Money. The markets, the papers, and the city. Today's need to know on Share Radio.
Every morning from 6 to 9, tune in to Morning Money on Share Radio.
With Sandra Kilhoff and Mark Johnson.
An in-depth look at the UK and global markets and business.
Giving you all the day's need to know.
Morning Money.
Getting you ready for the day ahead.
A very warm welcome. I'm Georgie Frost. This is Share Radio. Now let's take a little time, shall we, for some car envy. Rolls-Royce reckon they've made the sexiest model ever. The new convertible 6.6-litre twin-turbo V12 engine, customisable interior, can hit 62 miles an hour in under 5 seconds. Top speed of 150 miles per hour and a 16-speaker hi-fi with theatre and studio settings, should you want it. And you will pay for it as well. It'll set you back a cool £250,000. Rolls-Royce may be German-owned by BMW, of course, and the car may have drawn its inspiration from the classic Italian film La Dolce Vita and the beautiful Anita Ekberg. But importantly, it'll be made in Britain. Earlier, our reporter Matt Cox spoke to James Warren from Rolls-Royce UK in Scandinavia and began by asking him a little bit more about what inspired the new car.
We looked at the fabulous, very rare Rolls-Royce Silver Dawn models from the 1950s. You know, they came to the market at a time where the world was coming out a period of austerity, and they really sort of put a sense of Dolce Vita, a sense of very classic glamour back into automotive super luxury grand touring. So from a design point of view, there's certainly inspiration taken from that. And you know, the whole concept of the car, the boulevard, the most social, glamorous, sexy Rolls-Royce in history, certainly comes from that. But it's also about putting a very contemporary face on that. Our customer base is changed. It's a younger, much more tech-savvy, much more dynamic sort of audience. So, of course, it's quite right and proper that Rolls-Royce, whilst retaining an awful lot of that wonderful heritage, also cuts a very contemporary dash.
Owning a Rolls-Royce is many people's goal, or it's their dream car. Why do you think this is?
From the very early days of the mark, Rolls-Royce has always established itself as the ultimate symbol of attainment. You know, what other brand would you say the Rolls-Royce of? You know, it might be the Rolls-Royce of coffee, or, you know, the Rolls-Royce of aeroplanes, whatever it might be. And I think that that obviously sticks with people. I also speak to people around the world who say to me, I own the best British car, so I own the best car in the world. And I think that's rather important for a lot of people. So it's a very emotional moment, I think, for our customers when they eventually do come and they're handed their car by either our dealer or even our chief executive when they come to the home of Rolls-Royce here in Goodwood, England. It is that ultimate moment that they've achieved something. We always say there's no two Rolls-Royce customers are the same, really. They come from an incredibly diverse range of backgrounds, an incredibly wide range of places around the world. We sell cars on every continent, barring two very important and very unifying characteristics. Number one is, of course, they're very wealthy. But number two, they're incredibly discerning. They demand the very best. They have a very keen eye for quality. Generally, what I'd say is that over the last sort of 5-6 years or so, that customer base has got a lot younger. It's much more an entrepreneurial class. And we've increasingly introduced lots of women to the market around the world. So it's a very healthy, it's a very dynamic, and it's certainly a very interesting customer base.
You do manufacture your cars in the UK. Why do That's you think right. it's so important to keep this process within the UK?
Rolls-Royce belongs to Britain. Our customers from around the world, and we sell to customers, as I say, on every continent. When they come to Rolls-Royce, they know they're buying something British. They're buying something incredibly authentic. They are buying the best British car, and therefore they're buying the best car in the world. It is just inherent to our brand promise. It still is, and it always will be, that ultimate symbol of attainment. It's that ultimate watchword for quality, for authenticity, for beautiful luxury. We really are the most revered of super luxury brands in the world. You know, it's not just the most revered car brand. We are the world's pinnacle super luxury brand.
The new James Bond film is out soon, and we've seen quite a few Rolls-Royces in the films, but Bond himself hasn't owned one. Do you think we'll see Bond driving one soon?
I couldn't possibly comment at all. I would not want to speculate on Mr. Bond's car selection, though I suspect he would thoroughly enjoy a Dawn for maybe his one or two days off when he goes down to the south of France, and certainly a Wraith when he's driving up in Scotland.
Consuming issues with Georgie Frost, making the pound in your pocket go that little bit further.
So there you go, Simon. £250,000 tempted.
Oh, very tempted.
Yeah,
I might pick up more than
Have
one.
Have a chat with Mrs. Lambert, see what she says.
Maybe get rid of a bit of the house or something. You know, the great thing about a car versus a house is you can't drive your house to work, but you can live in your car.
But Simon, what do you get for your money?
You get what Rolls-Royce claims to be the sexiest Rolls-Royce ever.
It does look pretty nice, let's be honest.
What you get is rarity.
Well, no one else can afford it.
One of the world's, yeah, you get one of the world's ultimate status symbols. And Rolls-Royce has been doing really well over recent years. You know, the cars are still made in Britain. Yes, it is German-owned, but those cars are made in Britain and they're being sold to the world's wealthy. And the world's wealthy really like them. And they have managed to retain that cachet that they always had, but actually perhaps have managed to actually get more cachet, I think, because I think there was a time 20, 25 years ago where a roller was a bit nouveau riche kind of thing. And now they're definitely not seen as that. They are seen as one of the pinnacles of car design. And yeah, who wouldn't be tempted if they had the money? But there's a great quote here from the Rolls-Royce Motorcars chief executive, Torsten Müller-Ottvis. He said, "Our new Rolls-Royce Dawn promises a striking, seductive encounter like no other Rolls-Royce to date and begins a new age of open-top, super-luxury motoring. Quite simply, it is the sexiest Rolls-Royce ever built. The early day chill of dawn provides an erotic tingle on the skin, awakening the senses and passions as the day begins. So the name Dawn perfectly suggests the fresh opportunities that every new day holds, an awakening, an opening up of one's senses and a burst of sunshine." And continues on.
Poetic, almost.
What's the line? I'll have one of whatever he's having. But our readers like the Rolls-Royce.
They do like the Rolls-Royce because we've got another couple of luxury cars with which to tell you about. Before we do that, you did mention there that it's going to be built in Britain. Good news for British manufacturing. That's what we want to focus on, isn't it?
Yeah, and it is. And, you know, our luxury car industry has gone from strength to strength over the last decade. Rolls-Royce, Bentley, McLaren, Jaguar Land Rover's doing phenomenally well. The Nissan Qashqai, the new Nissan Qashqai, they've made 500,000 of them already. They make them up in the northeast. Mm-hmm. Most popular British-made car ever. Yeah, there's one every 62 seconds rolls off the production line, although as I understand it, it takes longer than 62 seconds to make one.
Well, let's hope so.
Yeah. But, yeah, so, the car industry is doing really well, and then that supports all those other manufacturers and engineers and high-tech businesses that sit underneath it. It's not just about making the cars. It's about the components for the cars, the design of the cars, and all the rest of it. And we have turned the British car industry from something that was a bit of a joke two or three decades ago into a world-class car industry that is renowned for its quality. So we should celebrate that.
Mark, we did hear this week Rolls-Royce hit by the slowdown in China, global sales falling 10% in the first 7 months of 2015. Not so sweet for Rolls-Royce at the moment, or is this just a little adjustment? Will they be looking elsewhere, perhaps the Middle East?
I think it's probably a blip, you know, considering what's going on in China at the moment, where there is a slowdown. People are feeling a bit less flush and there's been a bit of a crackdown on spending. But I do think it is a blip, and I think that probably Rolls-Royce will continue to do very well in China, in the emerging Asian economies, in places like the Middle East, the parts of the world where people are growing richer and also are quite keen to flaunt their wealth.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, Simon, you teased us with it, but Rolls-Royce aren't the only luxury car company in town bringing out a new model. Rival Bentley bringing out a new vehicle, this time a 4x4, the ultimate 4x4, apparently. A bit of a discount on the Rolls. You can get it for £160,000. And not to be outdone, though, Jaguar are launching their new 4x4 as well. A veritable snip, Simon. The Jaguar at £35,000. Bargain. So luxury 4x4s, what can you tell us about these cars?
People love them. People love 4x4s. They just snapped them up. The SUV, which is what it gets dubbed, the sports utility vehicle sector, has been the fastest growing one for a number of years now.
Why is that, Simon? Because I'm not a big fan of the height. It's too high for me.
I think people like the height. They like the driving around, being able to see what's sort of underneath them kind of thing. They feel more protected. They feel more safe. They've also got a lot of room inside. And they're very practical, so you're probably never going to drive many of these cars off-road. And in fact, quite a lot of them aren't even four-wheel drive, they're two-wheel drive. But you can easily chuck everything you need in the boot, and you can get all the kids in there and all the other stuff, and they're just comfortable to ride around in. So Bentley has decided to get in on the action, because it discovered a problem, which was that you just couldn't spend more than a certain amount on a luxury 4x4.
Yeah, that's a problem.
So Bentley went out and they solved that problem. So now you can have the £160,000 Bentayga. I think that's how you pronounce it. It'll hit 187 miles an hour. And they have revealed it this week in a rather strangely unstunning metallic brown colour that looks a little bit like an Austin Allegro Vandenplas kind of colour. Mm. I wouldn't have gone with this colour, and our readers aren't so keen on the Bentley. They prefer the roller.
I'm wondering, though, it might have something to do with this, the idea of the great outdoors, a 4x4. At the launch, there was even a hamper set complete with a refrigerator in there, and Bentley did say for comfort in the great outdoors, sections of the hamper can be removed and used as seats. And to which I've written, great outdoors, !! Chelsea tractor.
Yeah, so if you did want to have a picnic on the pavement in Chelsea, you could get your hamper out and turn your hamper into a seat.
Gone outdoors.
Well, no. Quite a lot of them will maybe drive onto a grass parking field at a polo event or something like that, and people will get out and sit on them. There is a wonderful photo of the Bentley parked on a sort of dirt track waiting to wind its way up a mountain that they've released. I'm pretty sure, though, that even though the reaction to the outside of this Bentley has been pretty mixed, and the concept of a 4x4 bumped-up Bentley, that once you were sat inside this car, it would be a very, very nice place to be.
I imagine so. It might have one up on my VW camper van. But, Rachel, I'm going to bring you in here. Thoughts about these cars, and then we'll get the views of This Is Money readers. But as someone not interested at all in cars,
I should just bow out of this conversation because I just can't look behind the
price tag?
The gas consumption.
Oh, gas consumption.
The levels of CO2 versus a standard runaround, if that's what you're going to use it for, running around. It's just extraordinary to justify that kind of...
But that's not the point. The point is it's the sexiest car ever.
Well, I just... And that, again, I just find so ludicrous, the way they describe. So this Rolls-Royce, the rear passengers do not merely get out of a Rolls-Royce Dawn, but rather stand and disembark. I mean, get over yourself.
That's
a load of rubbish.
And what have the readers of This Is Money been saying, Simon? Final point on the cars.
On the Bentley, KO says repulsive looking car. Glenjamin says would rather have a Q7 and a Range Rover for same money. Simon Cowell will be given a discount to own one soon. On the Rolls Royce, however, we have had people saying starting saving now, hoping to win the premium bonds. And then also a comment from one reader who says, although very beautiful, I prefer the classic lines of the old Corniche model. So for some, you cannot beat the classic.
Next up, we'll be exploring why, when we could save thousands of pounds by heading to online estate agents, do we stubbornly stick with the much complained about high street rivals? Because if you don't want to live in your car and you do actually want to live in a house, we're going to be talking about property now and house prices. First, let's talk about that, hitting their biggest monthly increase since last May, with the latest figures from the Halifax showing in year-on-year terms, prices are up 9% for the last quarter. The average price of a home now stands at just over £204,000. So briefly, it's that old supply and demand chestnut, isn't it, Rachel?
Yeah, and just it shows no sign of letting up, does it? There just aren't enough properties on the market. There are something like 30-year lows at the moment, and so then people don't put their houses up on the market because there's nowhere really that they see that they might be interested in moving to, and so the demand stays low. And as this happens, the price of properties, I mean, it's regional, of course, but if you look at it sort of as an average, prices just keep going up and up. The RICS has just revised their forecast. It was 3%. I think it's now 6% for a year. We thought this year, after the record growth last year, that there might be some kind of let up, but it's looking like short of a crash, no. Prices are just continuing to rise.
Tell us, is there anything being done at the moment, government, house builders, to sort this out? What is being done? Reassure us.
Well, I mean, there are moves to increase the levels of affordable housing, but by any standards or studies, nowhere near the number that we need in order to be able to keep up with demand. There are moves to help people to be able to afford properties, but arguably that doesn't look at the root of the problem. You can't just throw money at people so that they can afford the increasing cost of buying their first home. So no, not nearly enough being done, or not the right sorts of things being done.
Simon, you've been looking at online estate agents and why, when we can save thousands through using the likes of eMove, Rightmove and Zoopla, potentially we still head to the much complained about high street rivals. Well, earlier I spoke to Russell Quirk. Now, he's the CEO of eMove, who thinks we get wrongly put off by the term online.
There's a bit of a misconception about this whole online estate agents thing. It's a bit of a misnomer. We don't just deal through some sort of eBay-type feedback forum. I mean, most of what we do is on the telephone. So, you know, we've got, as I say, 25 customer service operatives that will take calls, whether it be about, I don't know, how many houses there are in a particular cul-de-sac, what's the best nearest school, you know, what next door might have sold for 3 weeks previously, whatever those questions might be. And we then will, you know, do the whole hand-holding bit all the way from point of inquiry all the way through to completion, exactly the same as a traditional agent.
OK, so Simon, on This Is Money, would you use an online estate agent to save £7,000 or are you too scared of missing out? You've also done a bit of a poll. What have you found?
Well, most people said they would use an online estate agent. So I asked this question, would you use an online estate agent if it could save you thousands next time you sell? 85% of people said yes, 15% of people said no. Now, I would be willing to wager that when those people came to sell their house, that 85%, 15% split would be nowhere near reflected. In fact, I would suggest that it would probably end up being the other way round.
But why is that, Simon?
Well, at the moment, the industry estimates that about 4% of sales are done through the low-cost sort of online agents and the rest is through the traditional high street. I think it's because people are scared of missing out. Basically, they go, yes, I could save this money. Yes, that's a lot of money. No, I don't really think estate agents do a very good job and I complain about them all the time. But maybe if I put it on with that high street agent, they might get me an extra 10 grand. I'll go with the high street agent. And then they go with the high street agent.
Better the devil you know.
Yeah, but I think people are making a mistake, really.
How can they make such savings, these online estate agents? Where are we seeing these savings come in? Up to £7,000, you're saying?
Well, yes, because, right, so I used the example of selling through Easy Property. Easy Property have recently started doing sales. They've been doing lettings for some time now. They've started doing sales. Now, their package, they've got a £475, including VAT, flat fee sales package, versus a typical estate agent's 1.5% plus VAT. if you sold a £400,000 home, you would save just under £7,000, which is a lot of money. And so why wouldn't you do it? I mean, why wouldn't you? Well, you might think, I won't get in the local estate agent's window. But Rightmove and Zoopla, the big property portals, they are the modern day equivalent of the estate agent's window. So do you need to be in the estate agent's window? No, probably not. You won't get a glossy brochure. But, you know, most online agents, they'll send someone around to do professional photos. They'll do the floor plans. They'll produce the advert for you. It will look professional. You won't have it in your hand. But do you need it in your hand? No, people, buyers look at your property on the internet. You don't want to negotiate. Well, a lot of them will do the negotiations for you. If you pay them a bit more, they'll even do the viewings as well. And so I think it's really interesting as to why people aren't going for this. And the reason why people aren't going for this is that fear of missing out. But where they save the money, sorry to answer your original question, is they don't have high street premises. They're not paying all of that money that the traditional high street estate agent is having to spend in order to basically market your property and do that simple thing of selling your property. They've got massive overheads, the high street agents, and these online businesses don't.
And yet we're seeing, I don't know about anyone else, it's purely anecdotally, a rise in the number of seemingly high street estate agents and also the ones that are looking like trendy wine bars.
Hey, who wouldn't want to walk into somewhere that looked like a trendy wine bar when they were going to buy a house?
I don't want to buy a home. There's
that window browsing thing, isn't there? Do you know what an estate agent once told me is that the whole estate agent's window is more important for bringing in sellers than it is for bringing in buyers. Sellers are attracted by the fancy branch and the window and stuff like that. They think those people are going to get me more for my house, more money than those people down there, whereas the buyers, they all look online. Now, I should say that I used two examples in my column, one of which is a colleague, an unnamed colleague, who is currently selling his house. Did you think about using an online agent? Yes, I did. Why did you use a traditional high street one? Because we just wanted someone to do it all for us, and we just didn't want any of the hassle. But actually, we've ended up doing most of it ourselves and it hasn't removed the hassle, and we're paying them an extortionate amount of money for some advertising I could have bought for almost nothing. But also myself, I used an estate agent when I moved 4 years ago. But the reason why I did that is because we were very close to the old £250,000 stamp duty trap. We needed to get someone to pay above that, to pay £270,000, and I was convinced that this agent could actually get us that money. And to be fair to this guy, he was a good estate agent and he did do it. I think it's all about service. You decide on the service you want and you pay for it. The problem is a lot of people pay all this money for an expensive estate agent and then they get bad service anyway.
We should point out, though, there are some very, very good ones.
And that's what
there.
I pointed out. There are some very good ones. And when they come into it, is holding deals together. Now, Rachel's been dealing with estate agents recently. So
you've got personal experience with this.
Yeah, I found a good one. After months of uncovering the most extraordinary dodgy dealings, I found a really good one. I can see why they paid them. And we had exactly that thing. They had to keep it all together when it looked like it was about to collapse. And it worked and we got our place and everyone's happy.
Very
good. It was a bit of good luck for us.
We're going to turn our attention now to banks, shall we? And start with some good news. For First Direct and Clydesdale Bank, at least, they've topped a poll for the most satisfied current account holders. Not so positive for the so-called Big Four. Lloyds, HSBC, RBS and Barclays all failing to secure a single top position in a survey of more than 10,000 of us. RBS ranked worst provider overall for a second year running. This all comes as Halifax have started sweetening the deal for new customers by offering them £125 for switching. NS&I getting in on the action as well, offering bonds that pay almost two-thirds higher than the rest of the market. But first, let's talk about our best and worst banks, shall we, Rachel? Why have the Big Four banks scored so badly?
Most of it tends to come down to customer service that they offer. There seems to be a complacency often among the larger banks that they take their customers for granted. PPI as well keeps ratings low of the bigger banks that many of them are still paying out, although they wish that they could curb it and put a deadline on PPI claims. They haven't got it so far, so that will continue.
It's also good news as well, we should say, for First Direct scoring above the rest. Again, they seem to do so well.
First Direct always come top of these polls, and I have a First Direct account, and First Direct is brilliant. Basically, you know that thing where you ring up your bank and you've got a problem and you think, oh, I'm going to have to endlessly go through people to finally get someone to sort this, and then they're not going to sort it, I'm going to have to phone them back and everything like that. Basically, you phone First Direct up, you tell them the problem, and they just fix it. It's amazing. It's astonishing. It's no wonder they always come top of these customer service polls. You're just shocked that someone's just done what you asked them to do.
But how are they able to do that?
I don't know. They've always made this massive commitment to customer service. They're not supporting a large branch network, but they are part of HSBC, which does.
Mm.
What surprised me was Clydesdale, though.
Your face.
I'm really surprised that they've come top for customer service because, to be perfectly honest, we have had a lot of complaints about Clydesdale over the years from readers, and Clydesdale has been dogged by problems itself, public problems that it suffered from. So I was pretty surprised, but it was named best provider for customer service in branch and was rated by customers as having the best switching service and the best app. So I'm pretty surprised by that.
Well, maybe they've turned it round, and congratulations to them.
Yeah, congratulations to them. But, you know, what's really interesting here is that some of these banks will not only give you really good customer service, but they'll pay you to go there. Both First Direct and Clydesdale will pay you to move. So it's no surprise that you've got more people switching bank accounts. It's no surprise that with all the dissatisfaction with the big banks, you've got more people going to smaller challenger banks. And I would say to anyone who's had their bank account for the last 5, 10 years or however long, you know, go, is this doing me any good? It's the product I use the most. It's the financial product I use more than any other. And am I happy with it? Does it suit my life? And if it doesn't, maybe get a better one. And if you can get one who'll pay you to move there, then even more of a winner.
And we are seeing, as you mentioned, there are those deals to get people to come on board. Halifax offering £125, but T's and C's always apply with things like this, right, Rachel?
That's right, and just always make sure that you work out what you need out of your bank and make sure that it's working for you. If you know, overdraft might be more important, online banking facilities. I know lots of people with First Direct love the customer service, but are less pro their online banking.
Yeah, the online banking's all right. They introduced some slightly crazy security system where rather than having one of these little card readers, you have to log in with your mobile phone. You have to put your password into your mobile phone and then you can use it on your mobile. But then if you want to do it on a desktop, you've got to get the password in there, get a code from there, get it in there. And you've only got 30 seconds. And it's amazing how you can't do something that simple in 30 seconds. But yeah, as Rachel said, one of the things to watch out for is things like if you get attracted to a bank account that's saying it's going to pay you interest if you're in credit, but you're the kind of person who regularly falls into your overdraft. Well, if you get one of these overdrafts that charges you £1 a day for being overdrawn, you'll soon find that that overdraft charge massively outweighs any interest that you earn from the bank account. So think about how you're going to use it. Don't just get suckered by that headline appeal.
And also NS&I offering some pretty good savings bonds as well. Tell us about those.
I mean, they've just been outperforming on all levels. I mean, primarily these pensioner bonds, if you were lucky enough to be old enough to get into that, £13 billion was plugged into those within just a few months. It just shows what savers have been up against, that when something good comes out, they go for it. But it's not just those. They're ISAs at the top of our tables at the moment as well. They're offering really good rates.
Well, from savings to spending, Rachel, and also on This Is Money, Britain is sitting on £173 billion debt time bomb. Now, investigation by Money Mail uncovering a startling rise, they say, in debt levels because we're splashing out on new cars, Rolls Royce, anyone? TVs, conservatories, and home improvement. And it's because apparently we're being lured into a spending splurge by banks and credit card companies. Tell us a bit more about this, Rachel. Why are we getting ourselves into so much debt?
It's so much debt. And I just think it's because money is so cheap. Personal loans, record lows. Credit cards, we just keep seeing longer and longer balance transfer. You can just buy stuff at the moment for years and not have to pay for it. And people are, it turns out, going for that. While rates are low, well, that's much easier for people. But the concern is that as rates start to rise, then people start to really feel it. I'm slightly concerned that the Bank of England has been telling us, you know, enjoy it while it lasts, while we've got inflation so low. Off you will go and spend. Well, people are. And now I don't know how they're going to raise interest rates without people really suffering.
Do you think in that regard that banks and credit card companies perhaps need to take a bit of responsibility and curb their sales techniques that land people in debt like this?
I got a letter last week from a credit card provider saying, congratulations, you are eligible to apply for. So it wasn't saying that if I did apply, then I would get the card. But it was a sort of gimmicky way of telling me that I should. But the way it was worded sounded like I had stood a better chance than someone else who might apply for it. One, it takes no consideration of my credit profile. If I did then go to apply for that card and was declined, that would be on my credit score. Not good news for me. But also, they just aren't taking consideration whether I could afford it or not. And what these numbers that MoneyMail has sort of compiled together are showing that lots of people can't afford it. And it's not necessarily that people, as rates start to rise, will necessarily default or not be able to keep up with their payments, although in many cases that will be the case as well. But the amount of money that we're spending servicing our debt erodes our disposable income, and then we're not spending on other things. It's bad for the economy.
Well, talking about responsibility, let's turn our attention to our final story, shall we? Rachel Rickard-Strauss in the studio with me, editor Simon Lambert from This Is Money. And soon you could be forking out 5 whole pence for your plastic bag. And more than that, of course, if you need more than one. That is, unless you are carrying an aquatic creature, where we're helpfully informed by the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs that not using a bag is not an option. The rules will come into force on October the 5th, but with all the various exceptions from loose fruit to razors, it's feared that this could cause a little more confusion. We headed out onto the streets of London to find out what people make of that 5 pence charge.
I think it's good. I prefer the other bags, like you can reuse.
My trouble is, I've got all these bags at home that are recyclable and I've never got them with me when I go into Sainsbury's, so that's why I've got bags today.
I think probably it's quite a good idea. You know that you're supposed to take the bags.
Yeah.
And we were late.
It's just lazy, isn't
we're
it?
We're lazy.
You know, I think we pay enough for our food. They should give us a free bag every now and again.
To put a charge to it, I think it's nuisance.
I think it's disgusting. You're giving them your money. You're advertising their shop and then they want you to pay for a plastic bag.
When you start selling bags, people will either reuse them, won't throw them away, you won't see pigeons getting trapped in bags. And for recycling, man, green planet, help the planet.
I think it's going to be a very smelly world because we all use them as dustbin liners.
There's a lot of varied views there, Simon. Just explain to us, what exactly are the new rules?
You're going to have to pay 5p. For a plastic bag that is more than a certain size, so a large plastic bag, and it's going to be all shops that employ more than 250 people. They're going to have to charge people this. And the idea is basically not to make money for shops or to make money for the government, but to stop the plague of carrier bags that the modern era suffers from. And I wholeheartedly support this. Yep. I think this is a good idea. I think that we are way too easily encouraged to take more carrier bags than we need, and that if you do charge people for them, it's a wonderful deterrent to doing so. It's not that much of a hassle to remember to take a bag to the shop. So take your bags with you, people. Get rid of the carrier bags. Save those poor pigeons that are apparently trapped in them all over the place. But what I would say is that DEFRA is wrong here. Mm. It says a bag intended to be used solely to contain live aquatic creatures in water. Not using a bag is not an option. Yeah. DEFRA, there is a thing called a bucket.
That's true. That is true. Thank you for pointing that out. And you can write them a letter to explain. The blanket charge on plastic bags has been in place in Wales since 2011. And there are reports that the use is down by 71%. But what about all those people that use it to line their bins, take their lunch to work? I suppose you can take a lunchbox, can't you?
But you can keep using the same bag.
Well, they get ripped.
You know, just
take more care.
Yeah.
Your views, Rachel?
A very smelly world. I like that. But 70%, I mean, you can't argue with that. If it happened in Wales, we can do it here. If we get our use of plastic bags down, yeah, use them again. Bags for life, you know, the cotton ones.
Jute bags, yeah.
What I would like to see a revival of is what we had when I was a kid, cardboard boxes. I mean, I know we still have cardboard boxes now, but shops used to have a load of cardboard boxes and you could take a cardboard box and you could put your shopping in a cardboard box, which is great for people who are driving to the shop and putting it in the boot of a car, and you can keep reusing that.
When I was young, editor Simon Lambert and journalist Rachel Rickard-Strauss from This Is Money, thank you so much for joining us.
Share Radio.